it's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. While COVID-19 has been dominating the health world for the past year plus, there's another big medical problem in the U.S. that's being overlooked, and it may be getting worse. Coming up, we'll look at the diabetes crisis and what we can do to try and reverse that trend. First, a lot of us have had different comfort and anxiety levels when it comes to going outside the house in a pandemic world. But many older adults, especially those in nursing homes, have had less of a choice and have been more vulnerable. Many have been living in facilities where, for months, outside visitors weren't allowed and group activities were cut back or canceled. Our next guest says we need to acknowledge how much trauma that may have created in these facilities, including for staff and residents, and use the idea of trauma-informed care to help people recover. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you living in a nursing home or do you have a loved one there? What has been like through the pandemic? Have you or your loved one experienced trauma related to this and the conditions during COVID-19? If you work in a nursing home, love to hear your experiences as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nancy Kasmal is an associate professor of social work at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She's worked in healthcare for more than a decade, including in nursing homes. Her research interests include trauma-informed care and the impact of trauma experiences on the workforce. She wrote a piece about nursing home residents and staff trauma during the pandemic. For The Conversation, Nancy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob. It's been my pleasure.
Trauma, the idea of trauma, is at the center of this piece you wrote. Can you give us a working definition of what we mean when we're talking about trauma in this context?
So in this context, I'm really talking about psychological trauma, the result of exposure to things like abuse, disasters, and other events that are harmful or thought to be life-threatening that are often out of someone's control. And the reason they're important is because they can have long-lasting effects on somebody's mental and physical and emotional well-being.
And this is something that you're hoping we think about in a nursing home setting, even apart from the pandemic. Why is it important to be mindful of the potential for a traumatic experience for people who have made it to that age?
Because really anyone might have had these experiences and that we don't know about. And particularly for people in nursing homes, they've had a lifetime to accumulate them. And they've most people, by the time they get to a nursing home, have had a number of major losses over the years preceding that, from the loss of their homes to maybe the loss of friends or spouses or other close people to them. They've lost their independence. And so all of those things can be cumulative, potential trauma on top of potential trauma. Now, just because somebody's had that experience doesn't mean they've had these adverse effects, but the idea is that we want to be aware that it could be there.
And that's in normal times. And now we have the pandemic for this last, year and a half now. And we know that nursing homes were hard hit from a health perspective. How did that play out when it came to trauma for those living in and even working in nursing homes?
So when you think about traumatic events, as I've just described them, it sees potentially life-threatening events. And you have this deadly disease that, you know, we didn't know a whole lot about at the get-go, that's now very quickly going through nursing homes. If you remember back to the beginning when there were shortages of personal protective equipment, when, you know, staff didn't know what they were walking into. And at the same time, in an attempt to protect residents, all visitors were cut off, all those group activities. So you didn't have any of the same social and emotional supports that people were used to. So right there, you have this potential for so much trauma. Just in the beginning part, and not even talking about, you know, how it's unfolded over the last 18 months.
We're talking to Nancy Kasmal, associate professor of social work at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She's talking about trauma and the need for trauma-informed care at nursing homes, especially in the aftermath, what will hopefully soon be the aftermath of the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest or an experience to share living in, working in a nursing home for seniors or with a loved one there. What were some of the challenges? What were some of the creative ways that nursing home settings tackled these concerns? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Nancy, here comes this idea now of trauma-informed care. And we've talked about that on the show, but I've got to admit, I usually think of it with adverse childhood experiences and trauma for kids and the schools dealing with it. Can you talk about trauma-informed care, what it is and how it would fit into this nursing home setting?
So trauma-informed care is really looking at any system of care. So a school, a healthcare facility, a nursing home, and looking at the way they do things around here and trying to reduce, you know, re-traumatization, reduce experiences that keep people from being in control. And so it can apply across any setting. And yes, when we talk about trauma, sometimes we talk about adverse childhood experiences, which some of these older adults in nursing homes may have experienced back when they were children. But we're also talking about things that can happen across the life course, domestic violence, disasters, and we just heard on the news, you know, wildfires and things like that. So disasters, natural disasters even, and surviving those can be traumatic as well. So we can't forget that people at any age can have these experiences. And if they're not resolved, if they're not dealt with, then they come back and people have to deal with them across the life course.
So what kind of things could, say, a director or a board of a nursing home facility do to introduce ideas or more ideas of trauma-informed care?
So the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, says there are six principles of trauma-informed care: safety, trustworthiness and transparency, peer support, collaboration and mutuality, empowerment, voice and choice, and cultural, historical, and gender issues. Well, what does that mean? That means that you're always looking for ways to ensure safety. And I'm not just talking about physical safety, because that visitation restriction we were talking about, that was put in place to promote physical safety. But it didn't address emotional safety at the same time. There weren't any, you know, stopgaps put in to make sure that people were able to maintain connections with family members on the outside. Trustworthiness, for example, through transparency, meaning that our nursing homes being open with everyone, with their staff, with their families, with their residents, about what's going on to really foster trust in that system. So those are the kinds of things that management can be thinking about in nursing homes around trauma-informed care.
Let's ring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Nora is with us in Madison. Nora, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Nora?
Good. So my grandpa, shortly after turning 99 last year, he lived in an assisted living facility. Unfortunately, he passed away after COVID got into his facility in April of last year. So it was hard to think about him being shut alone in his room, you know, during that time, the short time that he actually had to be there. And it was also hard thinking about him being by himself. They were allowed one visitor from 9 to 5 if someone was like actively dying. Unfortunately, he passed away in the early morning, so no one was with him during that time. But this show obviously made me think about what he went through in that short period of time, and what he would be going through now is if he had lived through COVID.
Nora, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm sorry for your loss and for that. I'm hearing a kind of an uncertainty, Nancy, and this has got to be a problem. I'm assuming Nora isn't alone. A lot of people remembering a loved one that they lost, maybe in this exact or a very similar situation in a nursing home last year.
Exactly. There was so much loss that happened over the last year, I mean, across the country. And for people who lost someone in a nursing home and weren't able to be there, it got right at the heart of that, you know, what we're told to do when we're caring for our loved ones. And being there and being there at the end is really one of those things that we're all taught. And so for those family members who now have to deal with the trauma of losing somebody at a time when they were being kept out is something that, again, people across the country and across the life course have to deal with at this point.
Nora, thank you so much for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Nancy Cusmall, an associate professor of social work at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She wrote a piece on nursing homes and trauma during the pandemic for The Conversation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or a loved one live in a nursing home? What has this last year and a half been like? The concern about the illness, the isolation through parts of this. Do you work in a nursing home? What would help improve the experience for your staff and for the residents? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Associate Professor of Social Work at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, Nancy Cusmall. She wrote a piece for The Conversation about nursing homes during the pandemic and how to help residents and staff recover from trauma. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe you have an experience to share living in a nursing home, working in one with a loved one in one. What has this last year and a half been like for you, for your family, for you and your colleagues if you work there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Nancy, I want to talk about the staff some at nursing homes. Even before the pandemic, we've talked on this show how it's a demanding job, physically, emotionally, certainly, not always very well paid, I understand. What kind of thoughts do you have on working conditions for people at nursing homes and what we could do to alleviate some of the stress that seems like it's just built in?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because the staff, as you said, at baseline, had a very stressful situation they were in with the low wages, with the difficult work. This isn't easy work. And with staff shortages, caseloads were already high, where nursing assistants who do a lot of that frontline, hands-on personal care were having to take care of more and more people. That just got worse during COVID. Staff shortages from people leaving the job, staff shortages from people getting sick, were rampant. And so those caseloads just got higher and higher, and they weren't able to spend as much time with residents. Again, keeping in mind that families and visitors weren't there, they were sort of that lifeline. And so we need to, when we think about trauma-informed care and coming out and dealing with the trauma of the pandemic, we have to really address those staff issues. Support, providing them with all kinds of support, like both emotional support to really looking at what we can do about wages and kind of structured support that can come out of the nursing homes. Keeping in mind that, you know, if we use this trauma-informed approach, they may have past traumas too that we don't know about. And so now we're asking them to deal with their own and the resident trauma over the last year. And they can't do that without our help.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Marie is with us in Fort Atkinson. Marie, hi.
Hi.
Do you have a story to share with us, Marie?
Yes. My husband is a 30-year vet. He had a catastrophic stroke. He's nonverbal. He's also paralyzed. And what's traumatic out of all of this COVID and restrictions, and I do understand it, is that my husband has received injuries, and the family not being there to find out why, you know, or what incurred and how he got these injuries has been very traumatic and helpless for the family. And also my husband, because I've asked my husband, you know, was this an accident? Did you do it? Or did somebody do it for, you know, do it to you? And, you know, I can see in his eyes when he doesn't reply to me, is like, I think he's, to me, the fear of retaliation. And that's very traumatic for the family also, because we can't be involved with him every day to see what's going on around his life in there. And it's just been one thing after another. And I get it. You know, the nursing home is understaffed and they're struggling also, but it just makes it harder for us because we have no control helping him control his environment.
Marie, thank you for sharing that. I'm so sorry you and your family are going through this. Nancy, I know we don't know a lot of the specifics here, but if a family member has a concern about the well-being of a loved one in a facility and doesn't feel like they have transparency, do you have any advice for where they would go, where they might turn next?
There are really two options. There's the long-term care ombudsman program, and those are trained advocates who work with families to help them serve as an intermediary between them and the nursing home. And every nursing home has one. And if you're not sure who your long-term care ombudsman is, you can always go to your state office on aging and they can connect you. The other is through your health department, whoever your regulatory body is. You can always make a complaint if you feel like something's going on that shouldn't be. And I think that our caller was talking to the larger issue of, you know, families and outsiders not being allowed in, is that they really are the eyes and the ears. And so that disconnect at a time when staff was already strained really took out, you know, some strong advocates for residents.
Marie, thanks again for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. We're talking about nursing homes, trauma, and trauma-informed care, especially during the pandemic, but not only during the pandemic. Nancy Kasmal is with us from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She wrote about this in The Conversation. Nancy, one big point you make in your piece is you're hoping that the approach here isn't that there'll be a top-down, now we have trauma-informed care at our facility, here's how you do it. You want to see patients, loved ones, and staff involved in creating policies and practices. Can you talk about why that's important?
Absolutely, because the trauma-informed care is all about giving the power back to people who don't have it. That traumas really come out of those situations where you feel like you're not in control of something. So the only way you can be trauma-informed is to share that power and let everybody have a voice in the, as I said earlier, the way things work around here. That is, and you know, what an organizational culture is. And so everybody should have a say in shaping what that looks like.
Do you see that happening? Do you see people acting on the kind of advice you're giving and bringing in people, the staff, the residents, and more, and doing the kind of things you're looking for?
In places, not as much as I would have hoped. Trauma-informed care became part of the federal regulations just before COVID, and so really didn't have a chance to get off the ground before COVID came and took the attention of in nursing homes and nursing home administrators. And so I'm really hoping that now that, I don't want to say that it's over, but now that we've had some time to see how this has played out, I hope we really spend some time figuring out the best ways to make nursing homes more trauma-informed.
Let's bring on another caller now. Margaret is with us near Duluth. Margaret, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Margaret?
My husband and I are in the car right now, driving to a state park to camp tonight, and we've heard this story. I have an elderly mother and father down in the Twin Cities. They're both in memory care. We have cameras in both of their rooms. And I would highly recommend that your viewers or your listeners look into putting cameras into their loved ones' rooms.
Are you doing this to be able to communicate them and see them, or to kind of keep tabs on the care they're receiving?
It's not to communicate with them. I'm part of a group of daughters and sons that have cameras in their parents' rooms. Some of them do use it to communicate with their loved one. Sorry, I feel like my voice is kind of shaking because I feel like I finally have a platform here. I can speak this and let people know. We do it to keep an eye on them for safety.
Margaret, thank you so much. We just have a couple minutes left, Nancy. Margaret and her family clearly concerned about the care that their parents are getting and the safety, and have gone to the point of having cameras in their rooms. Is this something that's common? What do you think of this?
I think it's a growing question. I mean, I have a colleague out at the University of Washington who has done a lot of work in that area, and there are pros and cons, like anything else, you know, privacy questions that come into play, but it's definitely a growing question, especially as technology increases. I do know some families that have used like Facebook portal kinds of things to maintain communication with their families especially during this visitation restrictions.
Margaret, thanks for that call. In our last minute or so, Nancy, who are you hoping takes the lead? As you said, as you see it, not enough facilities are doing this kind of trauma-informed care. Who needs to nudge this and make it happen?
Well, there needs to be buy-in from everyone, but the leadership really needs to take the reins and, you know, make sure that this is something their facilities are looking at. It can't happen without the leadership, but everybody needs to be involved in the decision-making, if that makes sense.
Nancy, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Nancy Kasmal is an associate professor of social work at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She's worked in healthcare for more than a decade, including in nursing homes. Her research interests include trauma-informed care and the impact of trauma experience on the workforce. She wrote about nursing homes and the impact of the pandemic over at the website The Conversation. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at America's diabetes crisis and what it could take to fix it. If you have a story about dealing with diabetes in your own life or a loved one or as a healthcare provider, we'd love to hear it. And you can get started right now. You can email us ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, or head over and post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Remember, you can follow all these great conversations here on the Ideas Network online anytime at WPR.org. You can stream live there or go through our extensive archives or download the WPR app to your smartphone or tablet. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, get the latest news about electric cars in Wisconsin and the charging stations and other infrastructure they'll need in the years to come. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, we've learned a lot from the COVID-19 pandemic, and not just about the virus itself or how people are responding to it. It's also shedding light on another health crisis affecting Americans, one that's been around long before COVID-19, diabetes. A few numbers for you. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 34.2 million Americans are diabetic. It's a little more than 1 in 10. Another 88 million, or 1 in 3, are pre-diabetic. Diabetes deaths rose 17% last year. Deaths among younger people went up 29%. And of those who have died of COVID in the U.S., at least 40% had diabetes. Plus, there are people with diabetes who never got sick from COVID but were harmed by the isolation and disruption it caused. It's a public health problem that we were making gains on a while back, but it may be getting worse now, despite spending billions of dollars on new treatments in recent years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or someone you know have diabetes? What is it like living with it? How do you manage it? And how has the pandemic affected your ability to control it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Roger Kuhlstedt is an endocrinologist with SSM Health Dean Medical Group. He practices mainly in Baraboo and Madison. Dr. Kuhlstedt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, those numbers I just shared seem pretty bad. Do they line up with what you see with the prevalence of diabetes?
Yes. So diabetes is by far the most common condition that we see. We don't know exactly how many people have diabetes in the United States because many of them are undiagnosed, mm-hmm. but the numbers that you mentioned seem more or less to line up with most estimates of how common diabetes is. Chances are that most of our listeners know someone who has type 2 diabetes. And we should also include type 1 diabetes in this group, mm-hmm. Which we estimate about 1 in 500 people, perhaps more, have type 1 diabetes.
And let's separate those two out to get the basics here. What is type 1 diabetes versus type 2 diabetes?
So that's a great question. Type 1 diabetes is a condition in which the immune system, which is normally in charge of fighting infections, makes a mistake, if you will, and it begins to attack parts of your own body. And in this particular case, the immune system attacks the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. And when that occurs, the pancreas can no longer produce insulin, which leads to high blood sugars and, if left untreated, something called ketoacidosis, which can be fatal. Type 2 diabetes develops a little bit differently. So in type 2 diabetes, the current theory is that people develop something called insulin resistance, where the pancreas is still able to produce insulin, but the insulin doesn't work as well as it should. And this is a little bit of an oversimplification, what ends up happening is the pancreas initially tries to compensate by making a little more insulin to try to get the sugars under control. But over time, either the resistance overcomes the pancreas's ability to make insulin, or the pancreas simply begins to fail, and the cells that produce insulin sort of burn out, for lack of a better term. In both cases, blood sugars begin to rise. Probably the biggest differentiator is that type 1 diabetes can occur regardless of whether you are overweight or not, and can only be treated with insulin, whereas type 2 diabetes, we tend to see a little bit more in patients who have become overweight, and you can use insulin as well as other medications for it.
What do we know, especially when it comes to type 2 diabetes, what do we know about lifestyle factors that contribute to our risk and things that we can control and then use to prevent developing type 2 diabetes?
So there are several studies looking at preventing type 2 diabetes. And we now know that there is a condition called pre-diabetes, where people don't yet have high blood sugars, but they are not entirely normal. So for reference, a normal fasting blood sugar is less than 100 milligrams per deciliter, and a person with diabetes has a blood sugar of 126 or higher. And so that if you are in that gray zone, if you have a fasting blood sugar after an 8-hour fast, and it is between 100 and 126, you're not quite normal, but you're not quite in the diabetes range. So that's pre-diabetes. Now, they've done studies to see what we can do to prevent the progression from pre-diabetes to overt diabetes. And one thing we know is that if you do nothing, if you leave pre-diabetes untreated, you have a roughly about 11% chance of developing diabetes later in life. Now, probably the most effective or the best study done looking at this was called the Diabetes Prevention Program. And what that study did was they looked at people who had pre-diabetes, and they divided them up into several groups. And one group, it was kind of their control group, where they really didn't do a whole lot different, kind of got some basic counseling. There was another group which had intensive lifestyle changes, which they defined as 150 minutes of exercise per week and a weight reduction of approximately 7% based on diet restriction. And then there was another group which got a medicine called metformin, which is a commonly used diabetes medication. And what they found was that every year that these people were followed in the control group, every year 11% of them went on to develop full-blown diabetes. However, the intervention group with the intensive lifestyle, 150 minutes of exercise every week, they decreased their chances of developing diabetes by about 60%. So we know that if you are able to lose about 7% of your body weight and you exercise 150 minutes per week, you will lower your chances of getting diabetes by about 60%. The group that got metformin, on the other hand, they were able to reduce their chances of developing diabetes by 30%. So as far as what can our listeners do, if you can exercise 30 minutes five times a week and monitor your diet and try to lose 7% of your body weight, you'll reduce your chances of developing diabetes over time.
Talking to Dr. Roger Kuhlstad with SMS Health Dean Medical Group. He's an endocrinologist. We're talking about diabetes, why it seems to be on the rise in the U.S., the risks, and how to prevent and treat it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experience. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hi.
Hi. I went from having more of a statement to, I guess, a question. I'm wondering about, I married a woman from England. Christmas cookie recipes, candy recipes, and she kept asking me what corn syrup was. Well, I'm wondering how much corn syrup leads in American diabetes.
Tim, thanks for the call. And Dr. Cole said, I've heard concerns that, well, A, we eat too much sugar in whatever form in the United States that raises our risk of diabetes, and some people concerned about high fructose corn syrup in particular, even as compared to other sugars. Can you sort that out for us?
Well, that's actually quite a challenging question to answer. I don't know that we can necessarily pinpoint that if you have a certain amount of corn syrup in your diet, that will increase your risk of diabetes or not. There have been some studies that have looked at excluding certain nutrients from your diet and whether or not that will prevent your chances of developing diabetes. One study that comes to mind is, you'll have to forgive me, I'm blanking on the name of it right now, but they basically tried to reduce dietary fat. They left the calories the same. There was no weight loss, but they just reduced the fat content of the diet. Now, this is a little different than corn syrup, so I hope that I'm still answering our caller's question. But when they just reduced fat content from the diet, that did not affect the rates of progression to diabetes. So there seems to be something that has to do with reducing the overall amount of calories that are being consumed so that you can lead to some weight loss. Now that, you know, I think it's reasonable to say that if you are consuming large amounts of high fructose corn syrup, you may want to try and make some changes to your diet. The one diet that has been shown to reduce the likelihood of progression to type 2 diabetes is the so-called Mediterranean diet. Now, what's interesting is there is no single definition of a Mediterranean diet. So if you look up Mediterranean diet, you will see different definitions. But generally, these diets are typically high in fruits and vegetables, whole grains, beans, nuts, and seeds. And they usually include olive oil as an important source of fat compared to other diets. They sometimes allow for some mild to moderate wine consumption. And generally, they tend to avoid red meat. They tend to rely more on poultry and dairy products as opposed to other sources of protein.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about diabetes in the United States with Dr. Roger Coolstead. He's an endocrinologist with SSM Health Dean Medical Group, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Is diabetes part of your life or a loved one? What kind of lifestyle changes has it required? And have you had concerns about COVID and its impact on people with diabetes? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about America's problem with diabetes. Dr. Roger Coolstead stays with us, endocrinologist with SSM Health Dean Medical Group. He practices mainly in Baraboo and Madison. You can join in with your experiences or questions about diabetes at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Coolstead, before we go back to our callers, I wanted to ask you about diabetes as a risk factor for lots of other things, as I understand it, heart disease and other conditions, and of course, a higher risk from COVID-19. Why is diabetes such a risk factor for other stuff?
Well, there's a number of different reasons why that can occur. So it depends on which risk factor you're talking about. So if you want to know, for instance, why diabetes increases your risk of heart disease, there's reasons for that. But broadly speaking, when blood sugars are elevated, that causes damage to the microvessels in your body. And, you know, we typically think of blood vessels as relatively large tubes where blood is transported. But the blood vessels in our body branch out into smaller and smaller and smaller vessels until they get to the capillary stage, which is a blood vessel about as thick as a strand of hair. And when blood sugars are high, the high sugars tend to cause occlusions in these little vessels. And so the circulation becomes affected over time. We know that if you have diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes, your risk for developing a heart attack is about the same as if you've had a heart attack previously. So when somebody has type 2 diabetes, they are at very high risk for developing heart attack because of these vascular issues that occur. The same issue occurs in the brain, so there's a higher risk for stroke, and there's also some damage that occurs to the blood vessels that feed the nerves in our body, which is where the neuropathy comes from. Neuropathy being a problem with the nerves that send signals to our brain. So people with diabetes can sometimes have damage to the nerves. Most commonly, we see that in their feet, and they can have painful sensations, almost like ants crawling on their feet or a burning sensation on their feet because of diabetes. Now, diabetes also is a risk factor for COVID-19. Particularly, it seems to be a risk factor for developing severe COVID-19. And, you know, there's a wide spectrum of how people can manifest the infection. Some people can have, a mild sniffle and perhaps a low-grade fever, whereas other people tend to become extremely ill and require life support and being on mechanical ventilation or something called ECMO. And one thing that we know, at least based on observation, is that if you have a diagnosis of diabetes, you are much more likely to have severe COVID. In fact, there was a study done here in the United States where they found that in the United States, the death rate for COVID was 14% in people who have diabetes, whereas it's 6.2% in people without diabetes. So we know that if you get it, if you get COVID and you have diabetes, your likelihood of getting severe disease and possibly dying is much higher. And what's an even more sobering thought is that if you have type 2 diabetes and your blood sugars are not well controlled while you are sick with COVID, the risk of death goes up to close to 30%. So that's about a 1 in 3 risk. And there's a number of reasons why that happens. In general, when people have diabetes, they tend to be a bit more susceptible to infections. The cause of that is probably related to how high blood sugars affect our immune system and the function of the white blood cells. But there's also some other potential mechanisms that are still being determined. There's certain receptors for an enzyme called angiotensin converting enzyme. And there's even some questions as to whether some of the mechanisms by which statins work could affect that. But just in general, if you have diabetes and you get COVID, that's not a good thing.
Let's go back to our callers now. Steve is with us in Oconomowoc. Steve, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have recently acquired diabetes as a result of having a partial pancreatectomy, and I was wondering how that fits in the scheme of type 1 versus type 2. Is it more like type 1 diabetes or more like type 2? And are the risk factors the same as for type 2, for instance?
Steve, thanks for the call. Pancreatectomy, I'm assuming Dr. Kolstad means part of his pancreas was removed. Is that does that lead to diabetes?
Yes. So, Steve, that is an excellent question and one that I often get from physicians even. So there are several different ways to classify diabetes. And what I had mentioned earlier was sort of trying to paint a broad stroke into separating the two groups out. So you can think of it this way. So the people that we usually think of as having type 1 diabetes, they have an immune disorder where their immune system attacks their pancreas. And we can actually measure these antibodies. The most commonly one is something called GAD65. Now, these people, the classic type 1 patient, they have the antibodies, and we also can see that their pancreas can no longer make insulin. So these are people antibody positive and can no longer make insulin. On the other hand, we have people that have type 2 diabetes who don't have these antibodies attacking their pancreas, and they can still make insulin. So these are antibody negative, and they can still make insulin. Those are the two extremes of the spectrum. Then there's people like you who had a partial pancreatectomy. And those people, or like you, they can't make insulin because part of their pancreas was removed, but they don't have the antibodies. Oh. And so it's sort of this middle ground gray zone. So part of this will depend on how much of the pancreas was removed. So if you still have some residual pancreatic tissue in place and your body can make some insulin, then you may have relatively normal blood sugars. In some people, when you remove part of the pancreas, you've lost a significant amount of insulin producing capacity, and so therefore you'll have high blood sugars. For general intents and purposes, I tend to consider a person with a pancreatectomy more like a type 1 diabetes patient than a type 2 diabetes patient. And the reason I say that is because a person with a pancreatectomy needs insulin. And especially if they've had their entire pancreas removed, you can't use oral medication to control that. They need to be on insulin.
And we'll have to leave it there. Dr. Kolstad, thanks for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Roger Kolstad, endocrinologist with SSM Health Dean Medical Group. We talked to him about a diabetes problem in the United States, how COVID-19 put diabetes patients at higher risk, and how to manage the condition. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, one of the three COVID-19 vaccines in the U.S. now has full regular approval by the FDA on top of the emergency use approval it already had. We'll check out that and other COVID-related developments. And we'll hear the story behind a Welcome to Cleveland message that greets air travelers in Milwaukee. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's a hot August day in Wisconsin, but the first signs of fall are showing up earlier than ever. Yes, it's the annual return of things that are flavored like pumpkin spice. The flagship of Pumpkin Spice Overload is the Starbucks Pumpkin Spice Latte. According to a release from the company, the PSL hit the stores today, the earliest ever, supposedly. But wait, according to NPR, Dunkin' Donuts got ahead of the game. They've had their Pumpkin Spice Latte out for just over a week now. I am a bystander in the pumpkin spice game. I have a strange and mild reaction to cinnamon and products containing cinnamon extracts, so I steer clear. But don't let me stop you. Here's another twist. A former coworker of mine by the name of Joy Cardine shared online something about pumpkin spice scented masks. I assumed that was a joke. But I did a little research, and yes, at least one popular chain store offers a 10-pack of scented face masks in a harvest pumpkin spice scent, though their website says they are currently out of stock. Me, I'll hold off for my favorite fall celebrations, the end of high humidity, the arrival of winter squash season. That's more pumpkin spice for the rest of you. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.